Levin. "Oh, that is a long and tiresome story. Everything is so indefinite in this country. But the point is that she has been living for several weeks in Moscow, where everybody knows her and him, awaiting the divorce, without going out anywhere or seeing any women except Dolly, because, you understand, she does not want people to come and see her as a charity. Even that fool Princess Barbara has left her, considering it improper. Well, you see, any woman in her position might fail to find resources in herself, but she... You'll see how she has arranged her life, how quiet and dignified she is. To the left, in the side street, opposite the church, shouted Oblonsky, leaning out of the carriage window. Oh, how hot, he said, throwing his already unfastened overcoat still wider open, in spite of 12 degrees of frost. But she has a child. I suppose she is occupied with her, said Levin. I think you see in every woman only a female, une couveuse, necessarily occupied with children, if at all, said Oblonsky. No, I believe Anna is bringing her up splendidly, but one does not hear about her. Her occupations are, firstly, writing. I can see you smiling sarcastically, but you are wrong. She is writing a children's book, and does not speak of it to anyone, but she read it to me, and I showed the manuscript to Vorkuyev, you know, the publisher. He writes himself, I think. He is an expert, and says it is a remarkable work. But do you think she is a woman author? Not at all. She is, first of all, a woman with a heart. You'll see. She now has a little English girl, and a whole family she is interested in. Why, is it a philanthropic undertaking? There you are, at once looking out for something bad. It's not philanthropy, it's kind-heartedness. They had, I mean, Vronsky had, an English trainer, a master in his own line, but a drunkard. He took completely to drink, got delirium tremens, and has deserted his family. She saw them, helped them, and became interested in them, and now the whole family is on her hands. And she doesn't do it patronizingly, just with money. But she herself coaches the boys in Russian for the high school, and she has taken the girl into the house. But you'll see her. The carriage drove into the courtyard, and Oblonsky rang loudly at the front door, before which a sledge was standing. Without asking the porter who opened the door whether Anna was in, Oblonsky entered the hall. Levin followed, more and more in doubt as to whether he was acting well or badly. Glancing in the mirror, Levin saw that he was red in the face, but he was sure he was not tipsy, and he followed Oblonsky up the carpeted stairs. On the top landing, a footman bowed to Oblonsky as to someone he knew well, and Oblonsky, asking who was with Anna Arkadyevna, received the answer that it was Mr. Vorkuyev. "Where are they?" "In the study." Passing through a small dining room panelled in dark wood, Oblonsky and Levin entered the study across the soft carpet. It was lit by a lamp with a large, dark shade. Another reflector lamp fixed to the wall illuminated a large, full-length portrait of a woman, which attracted Levin's involuntary attention. It was Anna's portrait, painted in Italy by Mikhailov. While Oblonsky passed behind a screen of trelliswork, and the man's voice that had been speaking became silent, Levin looked at the portrait, which, in the bright illumination, seemed to step out of its frame, and he could not tear himself away from it. He forgot where he was, and without listening to what was being said, gazed fixedly at the wonderful portrait. It was not a picture, but a living and charming woman with curly black hair, bare shoulders and arms, and a dreamy half-smile on lips covered with elegant down, looking at him victoriously and tenderly with eyes that troubled him. The only thing that showed she was not alive was that she was more beautiful than a living woman could be. "I am so glad," he heard a voice saying nearby, evidently addressing him, the voice of the very woman whom he had admired in the portrait. Anna had come out from behind the screen to meet him, and Levin saw in the dim light of the study the woman of the portrait, in a dark dress of different shades of blue, not in the same attitude, not with the same expression, but on the same height of beauty as that on which the artist had caught her in the portrait. In reality, she was less brilliant, but there was something about her new and attractive which was not in the portrait. Chapter 10. She had risen to greet him, not concealing her pleasure at seeing him. The tranquillity with which she extended to him her energetic little hand introduced him to Vorkuyev, and indicating a pretty red-haired child who sat in the same room doing needlework, spoke of her as her ward, showed the manners, familiar and pleasant to Levin, of a woman of good society, always self-possessed and natural. "I am very, very pleased," she repeated, and from her lips these simple words seemed to Levin to possess a peculiar meaning. "I have known and liked you both for your friendship to Stiva and for your wife's sake. I only knew her for a very short time, but she left on me the impression of a lovely flower. Just a flower." "And she will soon be a mother?" She spoke easily and without haste, occasionally turning her eyes from Levin to her brother. Levin felt that the impression he was creating was a good one, and immediately became at ease and as natural and comfortable with her as if he had known her from childhood. "We came into Alexei's room to have a smoke," she said, in reply to Oblonsky's question whether he might smoke. And glancing at Levin, instead of asking him whether he smoked, she drew a tortoise-shell cigar case nearer and took from it a straw cigarette. "How are you today?" asked her brother.
"Pretty well. Nerves, as usual."
"Isn't it wonderfully good?" said Oblonsky, noticing that Levin kept looking at the portrait.
"I have never seen a better portrait."
"And it's a wonderful likeness, isn't it?" asked Vorkuyev. Levin glanced from the portrait to the original. A special brightness lit up Anna's face when she felt his eyes on her. Levin flushed, and to hide his confusion was about to ask her if it was long since she had seen Dolly. But at that instant, Anna herself began to speak.
"We were just talking with Ivan Pyotrovich about Vashchenko's last pictures. Have you seen them?"
"Yes, I have," replied Levin.
"But excuse me, I interrupted you. You were going to say..."
Levin asked whether she had seen Dolly lately.
"She was here yesterday. She is very angry with the high school because of Grisha. The Latin master, it seems, has been unjust to him."
"Yes, I have seen the pictures, and did not like them very much," Levin said, returning to the subject she had started.
Levin did not now speak at all in the matter-of-fact way in which he had talked that morning. Every word of his conversation with her assumed a special importance. It was pleasant to speak to her, and yet more pleasant to listen to her. Anna not only talked naturally and cleverly, but cleverly and carelessly, not attributing any value to her own ideas, but attributing great value to those of her interlocutor. The conversation touched on the new direction taken by art and the new illustrations of the Bible by a French artist. Vorkuyev accused the artist of realism pushed to coarseness. Levin said the French had carried conventionality in art further than anyone else, and therefore attributed special merit to a return to realism. In the fact that they had left off lying, they perceived poetry. Never had any clever thought uttered by Levin given him so much satisfaction as this. Anna's face brightened all over when she suddenly appreciated the remark. She laughed.
"I am laughing as one laughs on seeing a very striking likeness. What you have said quite characterizes present-day French art, painting, and even literature. Zola, Daudet. But perhaps it is always like that. They form their conceptions from imaginary, conventional figures, and when they have made every possible combination of these, they tire of the conventional figures and begin to devise more natural and correct ones."
"Yes, that's it. Exactly," said Vorkuyev.
"So you have been to the club?" she said, addressing her brother.
"What a woman," thought Levin.
And quite forgetting himself, he gazed fixedly at her beautiful, mobile face, which had now suddenly quite changed.
Lievin did not hear what she was speaking about while she leant toward her brother, but was struck by the change in her expression. After being so lovely in its tranquillity, her face suddenly expressed a strange curiosity, anger, and pride. But this lasted only a moment. She screwed up her eyes, as if she were remembering something. "However, that won't interest anyone," she said. And turning to the little English girl, she added in English, "Please order tea in the drawing room." The child rose and went out.
"Well, has she passed her examination?" inquired Oblonsky.
"Splendidly. She is a very capable girl and has a sweet nature."
"You'll finish by being fonder of her than of your own."
"How like a man! There is no more or less in love. I love my child with one kind of love and her with another."
"I was just saying to Anna Arkadyevna," remarked Vorkuyev, "that if she were to devote to the general business of educating Russian children 1/100th part of the energy she bestows on this English child, she would be doing a great and useful work."
"Yes, but say what you like, I can't do it. Count Alexei urged me very much."
As she spoke the words "Count Alexei," she turned a timidly petitioning glance toward Lievin, and he involuntarily replied with a respectful and confirmatory glance.
"He urged me to take an interest in the village school. I went several times. They are very nice children. But I could not attach myself to the work. You mention energy. Energy is based on love. And where is one to get the love? One can't order it. I've become fond of this girl, you see, without knowing why."
Again she glanced at Lievin, and her smile and glance told him that she was speaking for him alone, valuing his opinion, and knowing in advance that they would understand one another.
"Yes, I quite understand," Lievin replied. "It is impossible to put one's heart into a school or an institution of that kind, and I think that is just why philanthropic establishments always give such poor results."
After a pause, she smiled and said, "Yes, yes, I never could do it. Je n'ai pas le cœur assez large to love a whole orphanage full of unpleasant little girls. Cela ne m'a jamais réussi. There are so many women who have created for themselves a social position in that way. And now, especially," she went on with a sad, confiding expression, as though addressing her brother but evidently speaking to Lievin, "now, when I so need some occupation, I can't do it."
And with a sudden frown, Lievin understood that she was frowning at herself for having spoken about herself, she changed the subject.
"I have heard it said of you," said she to Lievin, "that you are a bad citizen, and I have defended you as best I could."
"How did you defend me?"
"Well, that varied with the attacks. However, won't you come and have some tea?"
She rose and took up a book bound in Morocco leather.
"Let me have it, Anna Arkadyevna," said Vorkuyev, pointing to the book. "It is well worth it."
"Oh, no, it is so unfinished."
"I have told him about it," remarked
Oblonsky to his sister, indicating Lievin.
"You should not have done so.
My writings are something like those little baskets and carvings made in prisons, which Lisa Merkalova used to sell to me. She used to preside over the prison department of a society," she added, turning to Lievin, "and those unfortunate people achieved miracles of patience."
And Lievin perceived yet another feature in this woman whom he already liked so much. In addition to her intelligence, grace, and beauty, she also possessed sincerity. She did not wish to hide from him the hardships of her position. When she had finished speaking, she sighed, and all at once her face assumed a stern expression and became rigid. With that expression, her face seemed even more beautiful than before. But it was a novel look. It was outside the circle of expressions radiating happiness and creating happiness, which the artist had caught when painting her portrait. Lievin again looked at the portrait and at her figure as, arm in arm with her brother, she passed through the lofty doorway, and he felt a tenderness and pity for her which surprised him.
She asked Lievin and Vorkuyev to pass on into the drawing-room, and herself remained behind to speak to her brother.
About the divorce? About Vronsky? About what he was doing at the club? About me? Lievin wondered.
And he was so excited about what she might be saying to Oblonsky that he hardly listened to what Vorkuyev was telling him about the merits of Anna's story for children. Over their tea, they continued the same kind of pleasant and interesting talk. There was not a single moment when it was necessary to seek for a subject of conversation. On the contrary, one felt that there was not time enough to say what one wanted to say, but willingly refrained in order to hear what she was saying. It seemed to Lievin that all that was said, not only by her, but also by Vorkuyev and Oblonsky, assumed a special importance owing to her attention and remarks. While following this interesting conversation, Lievin all the time continued to admire her. Her beauty, her cleverness, her good education, together with her simplicity and sincerity. He listened and talked, and all the time thought of her inner life, trying to guess her feelings. And he, who had formerly judged her so severely, now, by some strange process of reasoning, justified her and at the same time pitied her and feared that Vronsky did not fully understand her. Toward 11, when Oblonsky rose to leave, Vorkuyev had already gone, Lievin felt as if he had only just arrived. He got up, regretfully. "Goodbye," she said, retaining his hand, and gazing at him with a look that drew him to her. "I am very pleased que la glace est rompue." She let go his hand and screwed up her eyes. "Tell your wife that I am just as fond of her as ever, and that if she cannot forgive me my situation, I wish her never to forgive me. To forgive, she would have to live through what I have lived through. And may God preserve her from that."
"Certainly. Yes. I will tell her," said Lievin, blushing.
Chapter 11.
"What a wonderful, sweet, pathetic woman," he thought as he and Oblonsky went out into the frosty air.
"Well, didn't I tell you?" said Oblonsky, who saw that Lievin had been entirely vanquished.
"Yes," responded Lievin pensively. "An extraordinary woman. Not on account of her intellect, but her wonderful sincerity. I'm dreadfully sorry for her."
"Oh, God willing, everything will now soon be settled." "Well, another time, don't judge in advance," said Oblonsky, opening the door of his carriage. "Goodbye. We're not going the same way."
Without ceasing to think of Anna, and of all the words, simple in the extreme, which they had interchanged, recalling every detail of the expressions of her face, entering more and more into her situation, and feeling more and more sorry for her, Lievin reached home. At home he heard from Kuzma that Kitty was well, and that her sisters had not long been gone, and he was given two letters. These he read in the anteroom so as not to let them divert his attention later on. One was from his steward, Sokolov, who wrote that the wheat could not be sold because only 5.5 rubles a chetvert was bid, and added that there was no other source from which to get money. The other letter was from his sister, who reproached him for not having settled her business yet.
"Well, we'll sell it at 5.5 if they won't give more." Lievin promptly settled the first matter with great ease, though it had previously appeared to him so difficult.
"It's surprising how all one's time gets taken up here," he thought, with reference to the second letter.
He felt himself to blame because he had not yet done what his sister asked of him.
"Today again I did not go to the court, but today I really had no time."
And resolving that he would attend to it next day without fail, he went to his wife. On his way, he ran over in his mind the whole of the past day. All the events had consisted of conversations, conversations to which he had listened or in which he had taken part. All these conversations were about matters he would never have occupied himself with had he been in the country, but here they were very interesting. All of them had been good, and only two things were not quite pleasant. One was what he had said about the pike, and the other was that there was something not quite right about his tender pity for Anna. Levin found his wife sad and depressed. The three sisters' dinner party would have gone off very well, except that he did not come in as they expected, and they all became dull. Then the sisters left, and she remained alone. "Well, and what have you been doing?" she asked, looking him in the eyes, which had a suspicious glitter in them. But, not to hinder his relating everything, she masked her observation and listened with an appreciative smile while he told her how he had spent the evening. "I was very pleased to meet Vronsky. I felt quite at ease and quite natural with him. You see, I shall now try to avoid meeting him again, but the constraint will no longer exist," said he, and remembering that, whilst trying to avoid meeting him again, he had gone straight to Anna's, he blushed. "There now, we say the people drink, but I don't know who drinks most, the common people or our own class. The common people drink on holidays, but..." But Kitty was not interested in the question of how the people drink. She had seen his blush and wanted to know the reason.
"Well? And where did you go then?"
"Stiva particularly begged me to call on Anna Arkadyevna." On saying this, Levin blushed still more, and his doubts as to whether he had done right or wrong in going to see Anna were finally solved. He now knew that he should not have gone there. Kitty's eyes opened in a peculiar manner and flashed at the mention of Anna's name, but making an effort, she hid her agitation and so deceived him.
"Ah," was all she said.
"I'm sure you won't be angry with me for going. Stiva asked me to, and Dolly wished it," continued Levin.
"Oh, no," she said.
But he saw by her eyes the effort she made to control herself, and it boded him no good. "She's very charming, very, very much to be pitied, and a good woman," he said, telling her about Anna and her occupations and the message she had sent.
"Yes, of course she is much to be pitied," said Kitty when he had finished.
"From whom were your letters?" He told her, and misled by her quiet manner, went to undress. When he returned, he found Kitty still sitting in the chair where he had left her. When he drew near, she looked at him and burst into sobs.
"What is it? What is it?" he asked, well aware what it was.
"You have fallen in love with that horrid woman. She has bewitched you. I saw it in your eyes. Yes, yes. Oh, what can come of it? You were at the club, drinking and drinking, gambling, and then you went... to whom? Oh, no. Let's go away. I will leave tomorrow."
It was long before Levin could pacify his wife. At last he managed it, but only by acknowledging that a sense of pity after the wine he had drunk had misled him, that he had yielded to Anna's artful influence, and he would avoid her in future. One thing that he sincerely confessed was that, living so long in Moscow with nothing but talk and food and drink, he was going silly. They talked till 3 in the morning, and only then were they sufficiently reconciled to fall asleep. Chapter 12. When her visitors had taken their leave, Anna did not sit down, but began pacing up and down the room. Though she had involuntarily done all in her power to awaken love in Levin, as at that time she always did to all the young men she met, and though she knew she had succeeded in as far as was possible with an honourable married man in one evening, and though she had liked him very much, Despite the marked difference between Vronsky and Levin from a man's point of view, she, as a woman, saw in them that common trait which had caused Kitty to fall in love with them both. Yet as soon as he had left the room, she ceased to think about him. One thought, and only one, pursued her remorselessly in different forms. If I produce such an effect on others, on this married man who loves his wife, why is he so cold toward me? And it's not coldness, for I know he loves me, but something fresh now divides us. Why has he been away all the evening? He sent word by Stiva that he could not leave Yashvin, but must keep an eye on his play. Is Yashvin such a child? But admitting that it's true, he never tells lies. Then behind that truth there is something else. He is glad of a chance to show me that he has other obligations. I know he has, I agree to that. But why prove it to me? He wishes to give me proofs that his love of me must not interfere with his freedom, but I don't need proofs. I need love. He ought to understand the hardship of my life here in Moscow. Is it life? I do not live, but only wait for a solution which is deferred and still deferred. Again, no answer. And Stiva says he can't go to see Alexei Alexandrovich, and I can't write again. I can't do anything, begin anything, change anything. I restrain myself, wait, invent occupations for myself. The English family, writing, reading, but all that is only deception. It is all a kind of morphia.
He ought to pity me,
said she, feeling tears of self-compassion rising to her eyes. She heard Vronsky's vehement ring at the front door and quickly dried her eyes. She even sat down near the lamp and opened a book, pretending to be tranquil. She must let him see that she was displeased that he had not returned when he had promised. Displeased. That should be all. She would on no account show him her grief, and still less her self-compassion. She might pity herself, but he must not pity her. She did not want strife, and blamed him for wanting to fight, but yet she involuntarily took up a fighting attitude.
"Well, you've not been dull," he asked cheerfully and with animation, coming up to her. "What a terrible passion gambling is!"
"No, I have not been dull. I have long ago learnt not to feel dull. Stiva and Levin were here."
"Yes, I knew they were coming to see you. And how did you like Levin?" he asked, taking a seat beside her.
"Very much. They only left a short while ago."
"What did Yashvin do?"
"He was lucky and won 17,000. I called him away and very nearly got him to come, but he went back and now has lost more than he had won." "Then what was the good of your staying with him?" she said, suddenly raising her eyes to his face. Her look was cold and hostile. "You told Stiva you were staying to bring Yashvin away, but you have left him." A similar cold expression of readiness for strife appeared on his face. "For one thing, I did not give him any message for you. And for another, I never say what is not true. But chiefly, I wanted to stay, so I stayed," he replied with a frown. "Anna."
"Why? Why?"
he asked after a short pause, bending toward her and opening his hand, hoping that she would place hers in it. She was pleased by this appeal to tenderness. But some strange evil power prevented her from yielding to her impulse, as if the conditions of the struggle did not allow her to submit.
"Of course you wished to stay and stayed. You always do what you wish. But why tell me? Why?" she said, becoming more and more agitated. "Does anyone dispute your right? But you want to be in the right, so in the right you must be."
His hand closed, He leant back, and his face assumed a still more stubborn look.
"For you, it's a matter of obstinacy," she said, after gazing intently at him, and suddenly finding a name for that look that irritated her so. "Just obstinacy. For you, it is a question whether you will conquer me, and for me..."
Again she felt sorry for herself and nearly burst into tears.
"If you only knew what it means to me. When I feel as I do now, that you are hostile toward me, hostile is the right word. If you only knew what that means to me. If you knew how near I am to a catastrophe at such moments, how afraid I am. Afraid of myself."
And she turned away to hide her sobs.
"But what is it all about?" he said, horrified at her expression of despair, and again leaning toward her, he took her hand and kissed it. "What have I done? Do I seek amusement outside our home? Do I not avoid the society of women?"
"I should hope so," she said.
"Well then, tell me what I should do to make you easy. I am ready to do anything to make you happy," he went on, touched by her despair. "What would I not do to spare you such grief as this about I know not what?"
"Anna, nothing, nothing," she replied. "I don't know myself whether it is this lonely life or nerves. But don't let's talk about it. What about the races? You haven't told me about them."
And she tried to hide her triumph at her victory. For the victory was hers, after all. He asked for supper and began telling her about the races. But by his tone and by his looks, which grew colder and colder, she saw that he had not forgiven her her victory, and that the obstinacy against which she had fought had again taken possession of him. He was colder to her than before, as if he repented of having submitted. And remembering the words which had given her the victory, "I am near a catastrophe and afraid of myself," she realized that they were a dangerous weapon and must not be used a second time. She felt that side by side with the love that united them, there had grown up some evil spirit of strife, which she could not cast out of his heart, and still less out of her own.
Chapter 13. There are no conditions of life to which a man cannot accustom himself, especially if he sees that everyone around him lives in the same way. 3 months previously, Levin would not have believed that he could quietly fall asleep under the circumstances in which he now found himself. That while leading an aimless, senseless life, one moreover that was above his means, after tippling, he could call what had happened in the club by no other name, after showing unsuitable friendship to the man with whom his wife had once been in love, and after a still more unsuitable visit to a woman who could only be called a fallen woman, and after being allured by her and having grieved his wife, that in such circumstances he could quietly fall asleep. But under the influence of weariness, a sleepless night, and the wine he had drunk, he slept soundly and peacefully. At 5 in the morning, the creak of an opening door awoke him. He jumped up and looked round. Kitty was not in the bed beside him, but on the other side of the partition a light was moving, and he heard her step.
"What is it? What is it?" he muttered, not yet quite awake. "Kitty, what is it?"
"Nothing," said she, coming candle in hand from beyond the partition. "I only felt a little unwell,
she added with a peculiarly sweet and significant smile.
"What? Has it begun? Has it?"
he asked in a frightened voice.
"We must send..."
and he began to dress hurriedly. "No, no," she said, smiling, holding him back with her hand. "I'm sure it's nothing. I only felt slightly unwell. But it is over now." She came back to her bed, put out the candle, lay down, and remained quiet. Though that quietness, as if she were holding her breath, and especially the peculiar tenderness and animation with which, returning from the other side of the partition, she had said, "It's nothing," seemed to him suspicious, yet he was so sleepy that he fell asleep at once. Only afterwards he remembered that bated breath and realized all that had passed in her dear, sweet soul while she lay motionless by his side, awaiting the greatest event of a woman's life. At 7 o'clock he was awakened by her touch on his shoulder and a soft whisper. She seemed to hesitate between regret at waking him and a desire to speak to him. "Kostya, don't be frightened. It's nothing, but I think we must send for Maria Vlasyevna." The candle was burning again. She was sitting on the bed, holding in her hands some knitting she had lately been doing. "Please don't be frightened. It's nothing. I'm not a bit afraid," she said on seeing his alarmed face, and she pressed his hand to her breast and then to her lips. He jumped up hastily, hardly aware of himself, and without taking his eyes off her, put on his dressing gown and stood still, gazing at her. It was necessary for him to go, but he could not tear himself away from the sight of her. He had loved that face and known all its expressions and looks, but he had never seen her as she was now. How vile and despicable he appeared to himself before her she now was, when he recollected the grief he had caused her yesterday. Her flushed face, surrounded with soft hair that had escaped from beneath her nightcap, shone with joy and resolution. Little as there was of affectation and conventionality in Kitty's general character, yet Levin was astonished at what was revealed to him now that every veil had fallen and the very kernel of her soul shone through her eyes. And in this simplicity, this nakedness of soul, she whom he loved was more apparent than ever. She looked at him smilingly, but suddenly her eyebrows twitched. She raised her head, and coming quickly to him, she took hold of his hand, and clinging close, she enveloped him in her hot breath. She was suffering, and seemed to be complaining to him of her pain, and for a moment, from force of habit, he felt as if he were in fault. But her look expressed a tenderness which told him that she not only did not blame him, but loved him because of those sufferings. "I am not to blame for it. Who is?" he thought, involuntarily seeking a culprit to punish for these sufferings. But there was no culprit. She suffered, complained, triumphed in her sufferings, rejoiced in them, and loved them. He saw that something beautiful was taking place in her soul, but what it was he could not understand. It was above his comprehension. "I have sent for Mama, and you, go quickly and fetch Maria Vlasyevna."
"Kostya!"
"No, it's nothing. It's past." She moved away from him and rang.
"Well, go now. Pasha is coming. I'm all right."
And Levin saw with amazement that she again took up the knitting which she had fetched in the night and recommenced work. As Levin went out at one door, he heard the maid enter at the other. He stopped at the door and heard Kitty give detailed instructions to the maid, and with her help, herself, move the bed. He dressed, and while the horse was being harnessed, for it was early and no izvozchiks were about yet, he ran back to the bedroom, not on tiptoe, but, as it seemed to him, on wings. Two maids were busy moving something in the bedroom, Kitty was walking up and down and knitting, rapidly throwing the thread over the needle and giving orders.
I am going straight to the doctor's. They have already gone for Marya Vlasyevna, but I will call there too. Is anything else wanted? Oh, yes, to Dolly.
She looked at him, evidently not listening to what he was saying.
Yes, yes, go, she said rapidly, frowning and motioning him away with her hand.
He was already on his way through the drawing-room when suddenly a piteous moan that lasted only a moment reached him from the bedroom. He stopped, and for a moment could not understand it.
Yes, it was she, he said,
and clasping his head with his hands, he ran downstairs.
Lord have mercy, pardon and help us,
he repeated the words that suddenly and unexpectedly sprang to his lips. And he, an unbeliever, repeated those words not with his lips only. At that instant he knew that neither his doubts nor the impossibility of believing with his reason, of which he was conscious, at all prevented his appealing to God. It all flew off like dust. To whom should he appeal, if not to him in whose hands he felt himself, his soul, and his love to be? The horse was not yet ready, but feeling particularly energetic, physically strong, and alert to meet what lay before him, so as not to lose a moment, he did not wait for it, but started off on foot, telling Kuzma to catch him up. At the corner he encountered a night izvozchik hurrying along. In the little sledge sat Marya Vlasyevna in a velvet cloak with a shawl over her head. Thank God, he muttered, recognizing with delight her little blonde face, which now wore a particularly serious and even severe expression. Without stopping the izvozchik, he ran back beside her.
So, it began about 2 hours ago, not more, she asked. You will find the doctor, but don't hurry him. And get some opium at the chemist's.
So, you think it may go all right? God have mercy and help us, said Levin as he saw his horse coming out of the gateway.
Jumping into the sledge beside Kuzma, he ordered him to drive to the doctor's. Chapter 14. The doctor was not yet up, and his footman said he had gone to bed late and given orders that he was not to be called, but the footman added that he would be up soon. The man was cleaning lamp glasses and seemed quite absorbed in his task. This attention to his glasses and indifference to what was taking place at the Levins astonished Levin at first, but he immediately recollected himself and realized that no one knew or was bound to know his feelings, and that it was therefore all the more necessary to act calmly, deliberately, and firmly in order to break through this wall of indifference and to attain his aim.
Do not hurry, and do not omit anything, he said to himself,
conscious of an increasing uplift of his physical powers and of his attention to all that lay before him. Having learnt that the doctor was not up yet, Levin, out of the many plans that occurred to him, decided on the following. Kuzma should go with a note to another doctor, while he himself would go to the chemist for the opium. And if the doctor was not up when he returned, he would bribe the footman, or, if that was impossible, he would enter by force and wake the doctor at all costs. At the chemist's, a skinny dispenser, with the same indifference with which the footman had cleaned his lamp glasses, closed with a wafer a packet of powders for which a coachman was waiting, and refused to let Levin have any opium. Trying not to hurry and not to get excited, Levin gave the names of the doctor and of the midwife, explained why the opium was wanted, and tried to persuade the dispenser to let him have it. The dispenser asked in German whether he might sell it, and receiving permission from someone behind a screen, took out a bottle and a funnel, slowly poured it from a large bottle into a small one, stuck on a label, and, in spite of Levin's request that he should not do so, sealed up the bottle and was about to wrap it up. This was more than Levin could stand. He resolutely snatched the bottle out of the man's hands and rushed out at the big glass door. The doctor was not up yet, and the footman, now busy putting down a carpet, refused to wake him. Levin deliberately took out a 10-ruble note, and speaking slowly but without losing time, handed him the note and explained that Dr. Pyotr Dmitrich, how great and important this Pyotr Dmitrich, formerly so insignificant, now appeared to Levin, had promised to come at any time, and that he would certainly not be angry, and must therefore be called at once. The footman consented and went upstairs, asking Levin to step into the waiting room. Levin could hear the doctor at the other side of the door, coughing, walking about, washing, and speaking. Some 3 minutes elapsed. To Levin they seemed more than an hour. He could not wait any longer. "Pyotr Dmitrich! Pyotr Dmitrich!" he called out in a tone of entreaty through the open door.
"For heaven's sake, forgive me. Receive me as you are. It's over 2 hours."
"Immediately, immediately," answered a voice, and Levin was astounded to detect that the doctor was smiling as he said it.
"Just for one moment."
"Immediately." 2 minutes more passed while the doctor put on his boots, and two more while he put on his clothes and brushed his hair.
"Pyotr Dmitrich,"
Levin again began in a piteous voice. But at that instant the doctor came out, dressed and with his hair brushed.
"These people have no conscience," thought Levin, "brushing their hair while we are perishing."
"Good morning," said the doctor, holding out his hand, and, as it seemed to Levin, teasing him by his calm manner. "Don't hurry." "Well?" Trying to be as exact as possible, Levin began recounting every unnecessary detail of his wife's position, continually interrupting himself to beg the doctor to accompany him at once.
"Don't be in such a hurry. You see, you are inexperienced. I am sure I shall not be needed. But I promised, and if you like, I will come. But there is no hurry. Please, sit down. Won't you have a cup of coffee?"
Levin gave the doctor a look which asked whether he was not laughing at him. But the doctor had no idea of laughing.
I know," he said with a smile. "I am a family man myself. We husbands are the most miserable of creatures at those times. I have a patient whose husband always runs away into the stable on such occasions."
"But what is your opinion, Pyotr Dmitrich? Do you think it may go all right?"
"All the symptoms are favourable."
"Then you will come at once?"
said Levin, looking angrily at the servant who brought in the coffee.
"In an hour's time."
"No, for heaven's sake—"
"Well, only let me finish my coffee."
The doctor began on his coffee. Both kept silence.
"Well, the Turks are being seriously beaten. Did you read yesterday's telegram?" asked the doctor, chewing a piece of roll.
"No, I can't stand it,"
said Levin, jumping up.
"So you will come in a quarter of an hour?"
"In half an hour."
"On your honour?"
Levin got home just as the princess arrived, and they met at the bedroom door. There were tears in the princess's eyes, and her hands shook. When she saw Levin, she embraced him and began to cry.
"Well, Maria Vlasyevna, darling?"
she asked, seizing the hand of the midwife, who came toward them with a beaming but preoccupied expression.
"It's going all right," she said. "Persuade her to lie down. It will be easier for her."
From the moment when he woke up and understood what was the matter, Levin had braced himself to endure what might await him without reasoning and without anticipating anything, firmly suppressing all his thoughts and feelings, determined not to upset his wife, but on the contrary to calm and support her. Not allowing himself even to think of what was about to happen and how it would end, judging by inquiries he had made as to the time such affairs usually lasted, Levin mentally prepared himself to endure and to keep his heart under restraint for something like 5 hours, which seemed to him within his power. But when he returned from the doctor's and again saw her sufferings, he began repeating more and more often, "God pardon and help us," sighing and lifting his head, afraid lest he should not be able to bear the strain and should either burst into tears or run away, so tormenting was it for him. And only 1 hour had passed. But after that hour, another passed, a second, a third, and all the 5 hours that he had set himself as the longest term of possible endurance, and still the situation was unchanged. And he went on enduring, for there was nothing else to do but to endure, thinking every moment that he had reached the utmost limit of endurance, and that in a moment his heart would burst with pity. But the minutes went by, and the hours, and other hours, and his suffering and terror and strain grew tenser. The ordinary conditions of life, without which nothing can be imagined, no longer existed for Lievin. He lost the sense of time. Sometimes minutes, those minutes when she called him to her and he held her moist hand, now pressing his with extraordinary strength and now pushing him away, seemed to him like hours, and then again hours seemed but minutes. He was surprised when Marya Vlasyevna asked him to light a candle behind the partition, and he learnt that it was already 5 o'clock in the evening. Had he been told it was 10 in the morning, he would not have been more astonished. He had just as little idea of where he was at that time as he had of when it all took place. He saw her burning face, now bewildered and full of suffering, and now smiling and soothing him. He saw the princess, red, overwrought, her grey hair out of curl, and with tears which she energetically swallowed, biting her lips. He saw Dolly. He saw the doctor smoking thick cigarettes, and Marya Vlasyevna with a firm, resolute, and tranquilizing look on her face, and the old prince pacing up and down the ballroom and frowning. But he did not know how they came and went, nor where they were. The princess was one moment in the bedroom with the doctor, and the next in the study, where a table laid for a meal had made its appearance. And next it was not the princess, but Dolly. Afterwards, Lievin remembered being sent somewhere. Once he was told to fetch a table and a sofa. He did it with zeal, believing that it was necessary for her sake, and only later discovered that he had been preparing a sleeping place for himself. Then he was sent to the study to ask the doctor about something. The doctor answered him, and then began talking about the scenes in the city Duma. Then he was sent to fetch an icon with silver gilt mounts from the princess's bedroom, and he and the princess's old lady's maid climbed on a cupboard to get down the icon, and he broke the little lamp that burnt before it, and the old servant tried to comfort him about his wife and about the lamp. He brought the icon back with him and put it at the head of Kitty's bed, carefully pushing it in behind the pillows. But where, when, and why all this was done, he did not know. Nor did he understand why the princess took his hand and, looking pitifully at him, entreated him to be calm. Nor why Dolly tried to persuade him to eat something and led him out of the room. Nor why even the doctor looked seriously and sympathizingly at him, offering him some drops. He only knew and felt that what was happening was similar to what had happened the year before in the hotel of the provincial town, on the deathbed of his brother Nikolai. Only that was sorrow, and this was joy. But that sorrow and this joy were equally beyond the usual conditions of life. They were like openings in that usual life, through which something higher became visible. And, as in that case, what was now being accomplished came harshly, painfully, incomprehensibly. And while watching it, the soul soared, as then, to heights it had never known before, at which reason could not keep up with it.
"Lord, pardon and help us,"
he kept repeating incessantly to himself, appealing to God, in spite of a long period of apparently complete estrangement, just as trustingly and simply as in the days of childhood and early youth. During the whole of that time, he was alternately in two different moods. one mood when not in her presence, when with the doctor, who smoked one thick cigarette after another and extinguished them against the rim of the overflowing ashpan, when with Dolly and the prince, where they talked about dinner, politics, or Maria Petrovna's illness, and when Levin suddenly quite forgot for an instant what was happening and felt just as if he was waking up. And the other was in her presence, by her pillow, where his heart was ready to burst with pity and yet did not burst. And there he prayed unceasingly to God. And every time when the screams that came from the bedroom roused him from momentary forgetfulness, he succumbed to the same strange error that had possessed him in the first moments. Every time, on hearing the scream, he jumped up and ran to justify himself, but recollected on the way that he was not to blame and that he longed to protect and help her. But when, looking at her, he again saw that to help was impossible, he was seized with horror and said, "Lord, pardon and help us." And the longer it lasted, the stronger grew both his moods. Out of her presence he became calmer, quite forgetting her, and at the same time both her sufferings and his feeling of the impossibility of helping her became more and more poignant. He would jump up, wishing to run away somewhere, but ran to her instead. Sometimes, when she had called him again and again, he was half inclined to blame her. But seeing her meek, smiling face and hearing her say, "I have worn you out," he blamed God. But the thought of God made him at once pray for forgiveness and mercy. Chapter 15. He did not know whether it was late or early. The candles were all burning low. Dolly had just entered the study and suggested that the doctor should lie down. Levin sat listening to the doctor's stories of a quack magnetizer and staring at the ash of the doctor's cigarette. It was an interval of rest and oblivion. He had quite forgotten what was going on. He listened to the doctor's tale and understood it. Suddenly there was a scream unlike anything he had ever heard. The scream was so terrible that Levin did not even jump up, but looked breathlessly with a frightened and inquiring glance at the doctor, who bent his head on one side to listen and smiled approvingly. Everything was so out of the ordinary that nothing any longer surprised Levin. "Probably it had to be so," thought he, and remained sitting still. "But who was it screaming?" He jumped up and rushed into the bedroom on tiptoe, past Maria Vlasyevna and the princess, and stopped at his place at the head of the bed. The screaming had ceased, but there was a change. What it was he could not make out or understand, nor did he want to understand it, but he read it in Maria Vlasyevna's face. She looked pale and stern, and as resolute as before, though her jaw trembled a little and her eyes were fixed intently on Kitty. Kitty's burning face, worn with suffering, with a lock of hair clinging to her clammy forehead, was turned toward him, trying to catch his eye. Her raised hands asked for his. Seizing his cold hands in her perspiring ones, she pressed them to her face.
"Don't go. Don't go. I am not afraid. I am not afraid," she said rapidly. "Mama, take off my earrings. They're in the way. You are not afraid? Soon, Maria Vlasyevna. Soon."
She spoke very rapidly and tried to smile. But all at once her face became distorted and she pushed him away.
"No, this is awful. I shall die. Die. Go. Go,"
she cried. And again he heard that scream unlike any other cry. Levin clasped his head in his hands and ran out of the room. "It's all right. It's all right. All goes well,"
Dolly called after him. But say what they might, he knew that now all was lost. Leaning his head against the doorpost, he stood in the next room and heard someone shrieking and moaning in a way he had never heard till then, and he knew that these sounds were produced by what once was Kitty. He had long ceased wishing for a child, and now he hated that child. He did not now even wish her to live, but only longed that these terrible sufferings should end.
"Doctor, what is it? What is it? Oh, my God!"
he cried, grasping the hand of the doctor who had just entered. "It's coming to an end," said the doctor, with a face so serious that Lievin thought that end meant death. Quite beside himself, he rushed into her room. The first thing he saw was Maria Vlasyevna's face. It was still more frowning and stern. Kitty's face did not exist. In its place was something terrible, both because of its strained expression and because of the sounds which proceeded from it. He let his head drop upon the wood of the bedstead, feeling that his heart was breaking. The terrible screaming did not cease, but grew yet more awful until, as if it had reached the utmost limit of horror, it suddenly ceased. Lievin could scarcely believe his ears, but there was no room for doubt. The screaming had ceased, and he heard a sound of movement, of rustling, of accelerated breathing, and her voice, faltering, living, tender, and happy, as it said, "It's over." He raised his head. With her arms helplessly outstretched upon the quilt, unusually beautiful and calm, she lay gazing silently at him, trying unsuccessfully to smile. And suddenly, out of the mysterious, terrible, and unearthly world in which he had been living for the last 22 hours, Lievin felt himself instantaneously transported back to the old, everyday world. But now, radiant with the light of such new joy that it was insupportable. The taut strings snapped, and sobs and tears of joy that he had not in the least anticipated arose within him, with such force that they shook his whole body and long prevented his speaking. Falling on his knees by her bedside, he held his wife's hand to his lips, kissing it, and that hand, by a feeble movement of the fingers, replied to the kisses. And meanwhile, at the foot of the bed, like a flame above a lamp, flickered in Maria Vlasyevna's skillful hands the life of a human being who had never before existed, a human being who, with the same right and the same importance to himself, would live and would procreate others like himself.
"Alive, alive, and a boy! Don't be anxious," Lievin heard Maria Vlasyevna say as she slapped the baby's back with a shaking hand.
"Mama, is it true?"
asked Kitty. The princess could only sob in reply. And amid the silence, as a positive answer to the mother's question, a voice quite unlike all the restrained voices that had been speaking in the room made itself heard. It was a bold, insolent voice that had no consideration for anything. It was the cry of the new human being who had so incomprehensibly appeared from some unknown realm. Before that, if Lievin had been told that Kitty was dead and that he had died with her, that they had angel children and that God was there present with them, he would not have been astonished. But now, having returned to the world of actuality, he had to make great efforts to understand that she was alive and well, and that the creature that was yelling so desperately was his son. Kitty was alive, her sufferings were over.
and he was full of unspeakable bliss. This he comprehended, and it rendered him entirely happy. But the child? Whence and why had he come? Who was he? He could not at all accustom himself to the idea. It seemed something superfluous, something overflowing. And for a long time he was unable to get used to it. Chapter 16. Toward 10 o'clock, the old prince, Koznishev, and Oblonsky were with Levin, and having talked about the young mother, they had begun discussing other matters. Levin listened to them, and at the same time involuntarily thought of the past and of what had been going on before that morning, remembering himself as he had been yesterday before this event. 100 years seemed to have elapsed since then. He felt as if he were on some unattainable height, from which he painstakingly descended in order not to hurt the feelings of those with whom he was conversing. He talked, but never ceased thinking of his wife, of the details of her present condition, and of his son, to the idea of whose existence he painstakingly tried to accustom himself. That feminine world, which, since his marriage, had received a new and unsuspected significance for him, now rose so high in his estimation that his imagination could not grasp it. He heard a conversation about yesterday's dinner at the club and thought, "What is happening to her now? Is she asleep? How is she? What is she thinking about? Is our son, Dmitri, crying?" And in the middle of the conversation, in the middle of a phrase, he suddenly jumped up and left the room.
"Send and let me know whether I may see her," said the old prince.
"All right, directly," answered Levin, and without pausing went to her room. She was not asleep, but was talking quietly with her mother, making plans for the christening. Made neat, her hair brushed, a smart cap trimmed with something blue on her head, she lay on her back with her arms outside the quilt, and met his look with a look which drew him toward her. That look, already bright, grew still brighter as he approached. On her face was the same change from the earthly to that which was beyond earth, as is seen on the faces of the dead. But in their case it is a farewell. In hers it was a welcome. Again an agitation, similar to that which he had felt at the moment of the birth, gripped his heart. She took his hand and asked whether he had slept. He could not answer, and, conscious of his weakness, turned away.
"And I have been dozing, Kostya," she said, "and now I feel so comfortable."
She was gazing at him, but suddenly her face changed.
"Let me have him," said she, hearing the baby's cry. "Let me have him, Marya Vasyevna, and he will see him too."
"Well then, we'll let Papa have a look," said Marya Vlasyevna, lifting something red, strange and quivering, and bringing it nearer.
"But wait a bit, let's first get dressed."
And Marya Vlasyevna put the quivering red object on the bed and began unwrapping it, and then swaddling it again, raising and turning it with one finger, and powdering it with something. Levin, gazing at this tiny, piteous being, vainly searched his soul for some indications of paternal feeling. He felt nothing for it but repulsion. But when it was stripped and he caught a glimpse of thin little arms and legs, saffron-coloured, but with fingers and toes, and even with thumbs distinguishable from the rest, and when he saw how, as though they were soft